whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to Five Questions, the podcast where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kiran Setia. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. One is that follow-up questions are allowed. The other is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do?
Hi, Kiran. It's nice to be here. I'm Sharon Street. I'm a professor of philosophy at NYU, and I work in the area of philosophy known as metaethics. So questions about the foundations of ethics. Are there truths about how to live? And if so, how do we know about them? What kind of truths are they? How do we fit them into our larger picture of the world?
It's interesting that you put it in terms of metaethics, not ethics more generally. I mean, this is a question that might overlap with things that come up later, but were you led into these questions by wondering sort of how to live, sort of first order ethical inquiry, or was it specifically the kind of puzzle of how there could be objective answers to ethical questions that gripped you?
You know, for me, I think ultimately it's all very intertwined. When I think back on what got me into metaethics, at some level, I think of it as, you know, I found myself here in this world, as we all do. And at some level, you know, you see all this stuff that's happening, and a lot of it seems wonderful, but a lot of it just seems awful. And so that's first order sorts of observations. And then you kind of wonder, well, how should I live in a world like this? And then it starts for me immediately getting more metaethical, like what's going on ethically in this world? And that leads you, you know, if you don't say believe in God, as I did not growing up, then you sort of wonder, well, what is ethics anyway? You know, this place, this universe doesn't seem to be governed by any kind of moral order. So yeah, what is it that's going on here? That's, you know, put incredibly broadly, but in a way there's sort of a mix there. It starts with first order sort of ethical reactions to the world that leads to a more general sort of puzzlement about the subject area.
Well, there's a natural transition from that to talking about Iris Murdoch, who also, I think, was working at the borderlines of ethics and metaethics and had shared this puzzle about what kind of role or status the good could have in a world without God. And she is the inspiration for the podcast. So she starts off by telling us that philosophy is not self-expression, but she also wrote, to do philosophy is to explore one's temperament, and yet at the same time to attempt to discover the truth. So I always start with this question: does your temperament influence your philosophy? And if so, how?
Yeah, and thinking about this, it seems very clear to me that my temperament influenced the fact that I went into philosophy and also sort of my interest in metaethics, the subject I became most interested in. I'm less confident about how much it has affected the substance of the views I've ended up affirming. But in terms of my temperament, you know, I've always been a pretty sensitive person, a person with pretty strong emotional reactions to things, both positive and negative. And so I guess like so many people, as a kid, I just found life wonderful and amazing and incredible a lot of the time. But then, you know, it doesn't take too long to find out that there are all these kind of horrors that happened. And I took those pretty hard. And I took the idea of death pretty hard as a kid. And then I think also in terms of temperament, I'm somebody who tends to want to dwell on things, you know, obsessive. I'm somebody who really likes order, clarity, to the extent I feel like I can get things very clear and organized in my mind, that, you know, helps me feel like I have some sense of control. So in a world that seems pretty confusing, you know, just seeking to get clear on what on earth is going on. That's a drive that, for me, allays anxiety, really, you know, if you can make sense of what's going on, even if you think what's going on isn't great. So I feel like those are the things that drew me into philosophy, trying to figure out, you know, what's going on, ethically speaking. You know, in terms of my more substantive views, like I say, on the whole, I feel like I'm just trying to call things as I see them in ways that, you know, I don't know that my temperament, how much it's involved, except there's one exception to that, which there's a certain part of views I've been developing recently where I've had multiple people explicitly tell me, Sharon, I think that's just you. You're really sensitive, you know, and you may think there we have this problem, but not everyone experiences it that way. And so maybe we'll talk more about this later, but in some recent work, I've been developing what's thought of as a sort of constructivist strategy to the vindicating ethics, where you try to develop an idea according to which there's some kind of universal problem that faces agents or valuers in general. And so I've ended up focusing on, I keep changing the name of what I want to call it, but most recently I've called it the problem of vulnerability to unmitigated loss. And essentially it has to do with, you know, we love things, we're valuing things, that makes us vulnerable to loss and just sort of pretty tremendous loss that can cause problems for the valuer sort of going forward. If you kind of have a clear-sighted view of your situation, that can ultimately be undermining of agency. Anyway, that's the very rough idea. But I've had people say, look, I think, a lot, you know, mellow valuers might not have the problem you're talking about. So that's one place where it may well be true that the temperament is influencing the substance.
Well, I do think we may come back to that in connection with some of the other questions. I mean, before we do that, I guess there are several things that really leap out at me from your description, and maybe I'll follow up on one or two of them. One is the idea that you turned to philosophy to allay a certain kind of anxiety about the place of value in the world and the difficulty of the world. I mean, in a way, it's leaning into anxiety, because you might have thought one response to that anxiety would be to avoid thinking about it rather than to keep reflecting philosophically, especially since philosophical reflection often makes things more problematic before it makes them less problematic. Like the anxiety can be ramped up. I mean, were you drawn towards it even as it made you anxious, or was that a complicated relationship with philosophy?
I guess for me, and this may be a matter of temperament too, for me, the worst anxiety can come from feeling like I'm ignoring something really important and, you know, kind of trying to push something away. I have a hard time doing that. So in a way, just trying to face things head on, you know, on the one hand, it can be anxiety conducive if you kind of conclude, oof, things are not not very good. On the other hand, I find that better than sort of suspecting that things aren't very good, but sort of looking away a lot. Like, and just the idea of trying to get the clarity itself, or like, you know, having things very clear and organized in one's mind, that's what I find at some level helps to alleviate anxiety. But as we may talk about later, you know, I think there are limits to how much analytic thought and the intellect can successfully do all that. But nevertheless, I think I feel more anxious when I find things just very confusing and muddled. And so clarity helps me feel better.
I'm going to ask one more thing about the way you framed your interest in philosophy before we get on to question two. And this is about your description of yourself as sort of sensitive, emotional. I mean, you know, the views you've ended up developing are, as you said, sort of constructivist views on which value isn't, in a certain sense, really out there in the world. It's a kind of construction of our own attitudes, our own responses. Mm-hmm. And when I think about intense emotional kind of moments of sensitivity, often the phenomenology of that, of those emotions, feels like it lends support to a kind of realism. It feels like the world is just impressing itself on me as having a certain kind of value or a kind of horror or a joy in it. I mean, was that true for you? Or was that, do you feel like the phenomenology of being emotional and being sensitive cuts against your constructivism, or does that description not really resonate with you?
Yeah, it's interesting. No, the phenomenology resonates up to a point. I mean, I almost want to say the sequence is something like this, like you observe the world and you have a pretty strong response of, you know, this is wonderful, this is beautiful, this is horrendous. And you kind of take that at face value. And I think you're cueing into things that are independent of us up to a point. But I think in a way, the sequence of my thought is that the fact that they, you know, I've always been sort of from day one, the problem of evil is the thing that made me find it impossible to believe in God. And so there's this sort of natural sequence for me in that, like, wow, a lot of what happens in this world is just horrifying and terrible. So it's sort of clear there's no one here, so to speak, but us and these creatures who happen to love things, who find ourselves in a world that isn't necessarily too concerned with what happens to us. And so it's kind of that transition to, well, the value sort of got to be coming from us and the things that we love and care about, as opposed to being, you know, something we find outside ourselves, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. I mean, I'm tempted to keep asking you questions about this, but maybe that we'll come back to them via some of the other questions, as well as coming back to your recent works. I'm going to ask you question two. Have you changed your mind about anything important in philosophy? And if so, how?
The answer to that is an emphatic yes. So for many years, I was pretty pessimistic about the possibility of vindicating any sort of robust form of objectivity in ethics. In a way, I think so many other people, was interested in that and hoped that, you know, there's sort of a philosophical account that could explain what exactly it is that a person is missing, failing to see when they treat others immorally. But I sort of felt that a lot of the available views just involved unacceptable epistemological problems, above all, that positing a very robust form of ethical truth, there was just no plausible account of how it might be that we could come to learn about those things. And I also liked the general strategy of Kantian style attempts to vindicate the objectivity of ethics, where you're attempting to show somehow that it's dictated from within an agent's practical point of view on the world, that you've got to live according to the moral law, say. But I just never found those arguments persuasive that try to derive it, so to speak, from reason. So I was pretty pessimistic and thought that we were left with a kind of subjectivism where, you know, at the end of the day, you just have different creatures who happen to value different kinds of things. As it so happens, many human beings value a lot of the same things. But I used to think there was really nothing to say beyond a certain point if you encountered a valuer that just had utterly different evaluative starting points. There was simply no objective subject matter there at the end of the day to say who was right and who was wrong. Anyway, that was my view for many years. But I've become much more optimistic that maybe there is a kind of secular foundation for ethics available that does vindicate a more robust form of objectivity. And maybe we'll talk about it more, but weirdly enough, that change in view originally came about for me as a result not of doing philosophy, but of doing meditation practice. And yeah, maybe that's something we can talk about, but I've become very interested, and it's an incredibly long project that's taking a while, but I'm working on a book where I do want to argue that there are certain insights into the nature of self that may sort of explain what it is that a person is failing to see when they fail to treat another person as equal to themselves.
Well, maybe we'll start at the beginning and I'll ask, when did you start meditating? Why did you start meditating? Like, what was behind that originally?
Well, it's funny. In a way, at some level, I started meditating because of philosophy in the sense that it was my first year of graduate school, and I found I was just incredibly stressed out. And also, and, you know, in a way, my temperament itself, you know, just taking things hard, feeling worried and anxious about many things. I turned to meditation initially just, you know, because it's so, I had heard it could really help with stress reduction. So I started doing, you know, reading Jon Kabat-Zinn's Full Catastrophe Living. That was, I think I first encountered it my first year in grad school. And so that's how it began. And I turned to it initially purely for the sake of kind of managing stress.
And then when did you make the connection with philosophy? Like when did that start to shift and become part of your meta-ethical thinking?
You know, actually many years later. It wasn't until after I got tenure, which perhaps wasn't a complete accident. You know, I sort of meditated on and off for many years because I did find it very helpful with stress. So when I was in grad school and then when I was on the tenure track, I was often stressed out. And sort of when I had time, I would meditate and I always thought, oh, this is great. It's really helpful. I should do it more often. You know, a little bit how it can be with exercise, just physical exercise. But then I never felt like I had enough time. But then finally, after I got tenure and had a year off, I thought, I'm finally going to get serious about meditation. And it was when I started, I took some sort of meditation classes and I just began meditating more regularly. And it was after that, that I suddenly felt like, wait a minute, you know, there may be sort of insights that are associated with Eastern meditative traditions that could help us with secular metaethics.
And this is where the idea that there's a sort of pervasive challenge of vulnerability to loss sort of comes in. Is that the connection?
The connection that ultimately struck me, I guess, is, I mean, so actually to relate it to stuff you've written about in your book, Midlife, I'm inclined to think that meditation practice is potentially can lead us to metaphysical insights about the self. And it's very complicated. And this is the kind of thing I'm attempting to explain clearly in this book that's taking forever. But in a way, it's the insight I have in mind, I think, is best captured in the Advaita Vedanta tradition, with a sort of ability to recognize in some very true sense self in others, like that there's a kind of underlying self that's present in all beings who have awareness. And so it was actually that was the thing that for me connected with metaethics. And some of this is probably just, I'm sure it sounds quite obscure, but it's what I'm attempting to explain in this work that I'm doing.
It's probably true that we're not going to get to the bottom of it in this podcast. I mean, it is striking that the thing you pointed to is a kind of more positive, hopeful insight than life is suffering.
Yeah.
Attachment is the, and we must extinguish attachment. It's something much more inspiring, I think.
Yeah. Well, and in a way, and there is a connection ultimately to the idea of a arguably universal problem that has a solution that's related to ethics. I mean, in a way, I was meditating in part because I found life pretty tough in a lot of ways. I mean, part of this, I don't want to sound like just this very depressed, negative person. Part of it, one of the reasons you can get upset is because you just love it all so much. And you think life is so great a lot of the time. You're just deeply attached to so much. You know, so there's a lot about the Buddhist picture that I don't quite want to accept. But this idea that, look, life can be difficult, but there may be a kind of insight available, I think not exclusively through meditation practice, but something that might helpfully be uncovered by it, that could in a way provide a kind of liberating way of continuing to live. I mean, that I've become kind of a believer. Yeah, that there is something surprisingly positive there that at the same time is consistent with recognizing that there's just a lot that is just awful for individual finite beings. Nevertheless, there's a way of kind of being with that where you can kind of keep fighting for the things you love, keep experiencing a fair amount of joy, even while not kidding yourself about reality.
Well, I think you've set me up beautifully for the next question by talking about the sort of duality of love and hate, because what I want to ask you for question three is, what do you love or hate most of all about philosophy?
Well, good. So in a way, when I was thinking about this, I'll speak simply about what I love. You know, there have been things I've hated about the, so to speak, the profession. But in terms of the discipline, I love it. And one way of it occurred to me to explain what I love about it is that in the meditation context, you know, there's a common idea that practitioners of meditation mention, this idea of beginner's mind and always trying to cultivate and maintain a kind of way of looking at the world that's just very open and attentive to reality, however it is, and, you know, free of preconceptions, and just trying one's best to see what's there without an agenda in the best way that a child might. And I feel like philosophy is sort of the discursive, analytical version of that way of approaching things, of kind of bringing a beginner's mind to the world. You know, there's just always, you know, it's always fair game to ask the most basic questions, be surprised by the most basic sorts of things, and kind of an ability to just over and over again try to see things in a fresh, open way where you're just not taking anything for granted. So that's one of the things I love about it, just that openness that we're all capable of having, of, you know, kind of just starting from scratch over and over again. Like, what is going on with all this? You know, with consciousness, with being here at all. I love how it's all up for grabs, and that kind of discipline as a group. On the one hand, developing all these, this expertise, and spending generations of people spending all this time thinking really hard. But at the end of the day, it's always open to you to think, well, is that right? That's what I love about it.
Yeah, I love that too. It can be magical in a way, I think. Maybe the next question will sort of continue this, because maybe we'll switch from the sort of discursive mode of engaging with philosophical questions to other modes. And I'll ask, is there a work of art that you love in part for its philosophical depth?
Yeah, so the work that comes to mind immediately for me, so one of my favorite books of all time is Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse. And I think so much of what I think is right, in a way, about the nature of life and what's lasting is sort of there. So, you know, on the one hand, that book is, it captures just so beautifully and vividly, I think, just the impermanence of everything. But above all, I love the character of Mrs. Ramsay, who on the one hand, you know, she has a, on the one hand, has a pretty bleak view of reality. She thinks that, you know, there's some line like, there's no treachery too base for the world to commit. And she, you know, thinks that she sees, you know, everything, happiness is fleeting, everything's sort of passing away. And yet, you know, compatible with all that, there are just these moments of transcendence that she finds in just the most ordinary places and events. And so, you know, these trivial, in one sense, happenings of, you know, there's a, anybody who's read the book knows that a sort of key event is a certain dinner party, and her finding, and then the character Lily Briscoe similarly finds, you know, just in these, in one sense, fleeting moments, something just utterly beautiful and a connection with something kind of transcendent. And in a way that it's a, to some extent, I think that's exactly right. Where, you know, part of it actually is human connection at that dinner party, Mrs. Ramsay, like these moments when you feel like barriers between people come down and people are simply happy together doing simple things. And there being something there that's enduring in spite of the transient nature of things, at least as it appears.
Yeah, I can see why that might be especially attractive to you and might even fit with some of the themes in your work. I mean, it's also a novel in which there is a central character who's a philosopher, and it's sort of about philosophy and philosophers in a more mundane way too. I think there's a passage maybe where Lily is talking about Mr. Ramsay and what he works on, and she says, you know, subject and object and the nature of reality. imagine a table when you're not there.
Exactly.
And I think of that as sort of a beautiful expression of the sort of vibe of doing philosophy in this early analytic period of G.E. Moore and Bertrand Russell in Cambridge, with which Wolf was connected. But there's also this idea of sort of, there is a lot of blurring of subject and object, that of sort of the porousness of consciousness. And maybe that does connect with the theme you're interested in of sort of the permeability of us to reality and to one another.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the things I love about that too, right, so I do love this fact of this philosopher, Mr. Ramsay, and then his sort of these young men following him around. And
yes.
I love the way Wolf puts it in Mrs. Ramsay's head that, my husband, he thinks and knows about all these great things, and I really have very little understanding of all of this. But then the way it's written, there are these moments when Mrs. Ramsay is kind of the one, you know, there's a pivotal moment at one point when Mrs. Ramsay says something, or she remembers saying to Mr. Ramsay of their children, they'll never be as happy as this again. And so she has these pretty bleak observations. And Mr. Ramsay, the philosopher, you know, who pictures himself ready to confront all unpleasant truths, in a way just gets angry. There's a way in which Mrs. Ramsay is the one who's able to look in a more unflinching way at reality at the end of the day. So I really like that feature of the book.
It's an amazing novel. Yeah, it's another topic it would be great to keep talking about, but I'm thinking we have to move on, sadly, to question five, the final depressing question inspired by Murdoch. It's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher, she wrote. What is she afraid of? So what are you afraid of?
Yeah, well, at some level, I was thinking about what to say about this. You know, at some level, I'm afraid of many, many things. I fear all kinds of things. But of course, we can distinguish between, you know, there are plenty of things that I fear that I don't think are worthy of fear. Things like I fear, you know, that I'll sound like an idiot on this podcast, for example. So I fear things like that. But I feel like I shouldn't fear that or whatever. That's kind of a so-called small self kind of fear. But then there are other things I fear where I feel like they are worthy of fear. And those, I mean, what springs to mind are things like I fear the potential collapse of democratic institutions and democracy in the United States. I have a lot of worry and fear about where that's all headed, I think. And I fear, you know, the prospect of climate change and the possibility that humanity is just not going to get its act together in time. You know, I'm very hopeful that we'll pull through all this, but I think things are a bit touch and go for our species at this point. And I fear that we might not pull it off. I'm hopeful that we will, but I think that's the kind of thing I fear that I think is worthy of it.
I can't resist asking you about another fear that you mentioned earlier on, or at least something you mentioned earlier on that could be an object of fear that you haven't looped back to, that I was sort of thinking might dovetail with the meditation and the sort of interest in Buddhism, which is fear of death. You said when, you know, that the prospect of death hit you hard when you were a young person.
Yeah.
What's your relationship to that fear now?
You know, I mean, I'd be lying if I said it was simple. You know, I think it depends on the day and the moment, really. There are moments when I still find it, you know, one of the most frightening things imaginable, not just my own death, but those of the, you know, people I love. But for reasons that I hope to spell out in this book project, I'm a lot more at peace with it and less fearful than I used to be. I think, you know, to the extent we can work on our conception of ourselves in certain ways, we can kind of, on the one hand, rightly fear or, you know, the end of this particular individual that we are. And yet at the same time, to the extent we can identify more broadly than just with this one single individual, then there's a kind of transcendent part of each of us, I think, that to the extent you can, you know, be concerned with others all across space and time, there's a part of us, I think, that is invulnerable in a certain way. And I think that to the extent you develop your identification with that layer of ourselves, then death does become something that is, yeah, less fearsome.
I'm going to end there. That seems like a perfect final moment. And I will say thank you, Sharon, for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Kieran. It's nice to be here.
Sharon Street is professor of philosophy at NYU. She's the author of A Darwinian Dilemma for Realist Theories of Value, Constructivism About Reasons, and other essays. Thanks for listening to 5 Questions.